Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue, and I'm an author, a journalist, and an ambitious priest being terrorised by an elderly widow. Joining me is author, fellow Caroline, and Ashes of Roses gown, Caroline Kipnis.
Hi, Caroline.
So excited to have you here.
Me too.
And I feel like the stock for Carolines is plummeting at the moment. Caroline Calloway is not doing wonders for us.
Do you get that emotional response when you see, like, over and over your name in this negative, like, awful light of, like, that God? Like, I didn't even – it's one of those scandals that I stayed away from because I was like, I don't have it in me this week to, like,
to read about my own name being dragged everywhere. It's weird because, like, it's not an uncommon name. Like, everyone's heard of Caroline, but it just doesn't come up that much.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like there's like Princess Caroline of Monaco and that's it.
Right. Or like I'm from Massachusetts originally, so the Red Sox, they're a baseball team. Sweet right. Caroline is their song. So when I go home, it's like a good thing. But I was in LA a few weeks ago in a Starbucks and the guy's like, oh God, you must hear the song Sweet Caroline sung to you every day. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, yeah. How awful. I'm like, oh, it's a wonderful song.
It's
like, what is happening?
Song.
Like, it's, yeah.
Also, Outkast have a great, it's a great
yes.
name.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually something that comes up. People are flagging it with me on this podcast now because I'm always talking about Carolines in literature who suck because there's just so many.
Yes.
It's always like a bitchy wife. Do you have a Caroline in literature that you despise?
Wow. Yeah, I feel like there are a few. I think of Made in Manhattan, the movie.
Yes, Natasha Richardson.
Yeah, because I name dropped her in my book and it kind of jumped out at me. It's like, oh God. Like, it was like that rich bitch Caroline.
I'm
like,
rich socialite bitches trying to steal mm-hmm. some hardworking woman's man.
Amen. Yes.
I'm so glad that we are seeing my die yes. in this.
And look at us. We're the nicest people. We're not Carolines. I'm like, the Carolines are the...
Yeah,
it's,
they're yes. the ones you have to watch out for. They're the yes. horse-faced equestrian yes. women who will just say something snide then ride off.
Right.
Carolines, mm-hmm. beautiful people.
Lines are good, yes.
Yeah. Today we're talking about the Thornbirds, which is, it's taking me, 6 minutes of this podcast yes. to announce that. I am so excited that you're here to talk about it. We've been trying to set this up for a long time. Tell me how you came to the Thornbirds and what it means to you.
My mom gave it to me.
Right.
So it was also that insight into her because in that way I was a freshman in high school and I was like a very young freshman,
right.
like very inexperienced. And I had my first job out mm-hmm. in the world that was a little scary. It was the off season on Cape Cod where I'm from.
Sure.
So like an empty tourist town. And it was an ice cream shop down an alley. And I was in there by myself.
So
and
American.
The owners, yes, gave me this machete. And they were like, just in case. And I'm like, I can't lift this. So it was already, I was in this like dramatic and overactive imagination state
yeah.
where like no one would come in. So I start reading the Thornbirds in there and I'm reading it like, why does my mom like this? And getting so addicted to it. And it's the most wonderful sense memory of working there. And I would go lock the door because you know how it is with
yeah.
this book. Like
yeah.
the world does not exist. And I would put the clothes sign up and then some family would be like, no, like I'd be sobbing and like, you don't understand. Like right now,
Maggie has to like, marry a
yeah,
rapist.
Yes. Like this is not the time for this. So yeah, the whole reading experience was like, it was the combination of the book and the experience
yeah.
and the being young and then looking at my mom in this new light, like, what does this mean to her?
Yes. And also there's so much in this book about like looking at one's mother
yes.
and seeing the deep web of desire and hate.
Yes, yes.
So it must have been a real
yes.
experience. I feel like my experience with this book is a little bit more like odd and cerebral in that like, so I have an older sister who I name check on this podcast a lot because she gave me a lot of the most disturbing books that I've ever read, which is the role of older sisters. And she started reading it and she was obsessed with it. So she was always like, I think I was too young probably to have read it at the time, but she was always relating to me exactly what was happening.
Oh gosh.
So I felt like I was like in it with her. And then
yes.
I watched like bits of the TV series with her, but then parts of that I was too kind of young to understand either. And then years later, I read it, but even that was an abridged version.
Oh.
So this time, it's
didn't know there was such a thing.
Well, there's a lot of extraneous detail.
Are there pictures in it? Yeah. I love that. I love that kind of book where it's like, it's so in your face that it is the world.
Yeah.
And that's where you do cease to exist in the outside world, because there, everything is, even rereading it now, like parts of it, I'm like, oh my God, like this could have all been said in a page, and thank God it wasn't.
Right.
I like that excess.
Oh, there's so much of this book. There's 700 pages,
mm-hmm.
like seemingly about this one love story, but there's just so many bits and pieces just about like, there'd be bits about the mailman who would yes. go on forever.
Yeah, and then there's so many stories that could have like gone and then they don't, and then,
yeah.
you know, it's like, but it's, I feel like that's part of the spirit too of all the stories that are not told or not meant to be told. You know,
I just
it's also inherently melodramatic.
It really is. And I just love a good intergenerational saga book.
Yes.
Have you ever had the courage to write one? So I think our listeners know you wrote most famously You, which was turned into a fabulous Netflix drama. Mm-hmm. But you tend to write sort of a murdery thriller, Patricia Highsmith type stuff.
And again, one perspective. So I did, like early on, I had a lot of short stories, mm-hmm. and I did an embarrassing thing where I had that notion that like, these are actually a book. And if I put them all together and
there.
Search and replace some names, then I've got myself an intergenerational novel.
Yeah.
And no, I didn't, but I sure sent it out like I did. And I got the kindest feedback where I couldn't, like, people did read it, like agents, yeah. like seriously, and were like, I was a little confused at the end. I'm like, yes, you were, because what are they all doing on that boat? It doesn't make any sense. Like, it doesn't make any sense at all.
But, it must be the hardest yourself. Kind of book to write.
Yeah, but it's so fun to, I mean, I loved, like,
oh,
mapping it.
And
I wanted, yes, yeah. it's such a, in theory. But yeah, how did she do this? Like, how... And did, like, this was clearly had to be plotting, not pantsing to a degree. But then you can feel the pantsing of just like.
Sorry, plotting, not.
Oh, when you plan everything ahead versus like flying by the seat of your pants.
Oh, plotting, not pantsing.
Yes.
I love that's very Boston.
Yes.
I don't know why, but I feel
yeah,
as though it is.
Well, pants, everyone here says trousers.
Yeah.
So there's, yes.
Yes.
Trousing is different.
Trousering. All right, I'm going to do a quick plot summary. Again, because this is just a sprawling thing, and because it is about more than the relationship, but for the purposes of this, we're going to focus on the relationship. Okay. The Thornbirds is an epic intergenerational saga that centers on the Cleary family. The Clearys are an Irish Catholic brood who moved from New Zealand to Australia at the beginning of the 20th century with their large family of sons and only daughter, Meggie. They work and live in Drogheda, a huge estate owned by Paddy Cleary's rich sister, Mary Carson. It is here the Clearys meet Father Ralph de Bricassat, an ambitious young priest who is depending on Mary Carson's patronage to get him out of the outback. However, after Ralph forms a connection with young Meggie, Mary starts a war for Ralph's soul that means him and Meggie are constantly unrequited. I don't know how good a job I did of summing up this book.
There it is.
So many
constantly
weird dynamics.
Unrequited. Yes. I like that every single dynamic is weird and tainted. That's what I loved about it.
Yeah.
Like, it makes you look at every family and wonder, like, you know, what's underneath that.
It's the most insane love triangle ever concocted, because it's between a celibate Catholic priest, a old woman, and a young child.
Yep. Oh, it's so perfect for 2019 times. Yes.
It really is. And like, we're now in the time of the like post Fleabag of like the priest being an object of desire again.
Right.
People are all obsessed with Andrew Scott, but this was the OG priest lust.
Oh,
right?
God, yes. Mm-hmm.
So explain to us the what you recall of that sort of the dynamic that gets this whole thing started, which is the Mary Carson, Meggie Cleary.
I mean, that
fight for Ralph. To
yeah. Like they're being this who is so evil. And has that controlling spirit. But for me, it was that knowing that he'd already made this commitment. And that's what makes her so evil, that like she understands him. So when a woman in particular is an evil genius, is there anything scarier than
so
a woman
evil.
Who's smart and selfish? And then young Meggie, like, and just getting screwed over left and right. But also the way that, again, it felt like he had that emotional impotence. And that's why he chose the Lord.
The Lord.
You know what I mean? Like... It felt because that was what I know. I remember thinking like, oh, no matter what, like Mary is awful, terrible. But he's also you just want to smack him.
I know
like,
he's married to the worst bad wife of all. God.
Yes. Yeah. And obviously not like crazy about her. Him. Yes.
It's so weird. So for our readers who don't remember it or haven't read it or whatever. So Mary Carson, to me, I picture her like Bunny from Sex and the City. You know,
oh my God,
Trey's
yes.
mother.
Total Bunny. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Bunny. So imagine Bunny. Mm-hmm. And so she is the sort of the widow who owns this huge £13 million estate. And she fixates on Father Ralph, who's this beautiful priest at the very beginning of the novel. And she's like, basically, oh, if you kind of stick by me and like very implicitly, like, if you fuck me, mm-hmm. I will leave you everything. And he is like, I am a priest and you are old and gross. And then...
Horny bunny.
Horny bunny. I don't like Mandarin food.
Yes, yes. I don't like Mandarin child.
For listeners, that is a Sex and the City reference. We are not racist.
We are, yes, no. We are quoting bunny.
Quoting bunny. And then... So then the Clearys show up, her sort of poor relations who she wants to take over Drogheda after she dies, but it's still going to make them live on the outskirts of the property in like a shithole where they almost freeze to death.
Yep.
And so Meggie is like 9 and Father Ralph, in what is like extremely groomy, but also tender, but also very groomy, is like, oh, I love this child because she's the only daughter of this like very rough farming family. Like, she's completely neglected. Nobody loves her. And I can't love a woman. So I'm going to kind of love this child in this really pure way.
Again, a story we would never get now. You know, like, just never.
You know, relatable story.
You, like, that was romantic to me and sweet. And I had, like, and then in high school, I had teachers that were very much that way. And then looking back, I'm like, oh, I was in Thornbird's mindset, too, of like, oh, like, older men can, like, love you in a way that is, it's inherently... It has to be unrequited, but it's so pure and beautiful. And I'm like, oh, the Thornbirds did a good job.
Right. So I talk with my friend a lot of like chicken or the egg. Do you know what I mean? It's like, there's so many books I have read that have this inherently like young girl, older man sort of protege relationship between this. I actually recently read Fire and Hemlock by Diana Wynne Jones, which is a similar dynamic. It makes me think like, do I find this kind of thing kind of itchy and sort of sexy and I want to read about it and like the idea of a woman knowing someone as a child and then growing up into a woman and kind of ensnaring him? Why is that so interesting to me? Is it because literature tells me, or is it because there's something inside my brain that wants it?
Yeah, and I think it has to do with destiny too. That when we're, you know, we all are filled with those ideas about the one and the chemistry kind of overriding everything in life.
Yeah.
So it is like it's kind of testing the theory that like if two people are meant to be together, theoretically, they could meet when she's 3 and he's, you know, 20, it's fucked up, but it also has that sweet destiny element to it.
Right.
So yeah, that's where it didn't to me, like when I was like, this felt pure to me in the sense that like, oh, like he sees like it starts with a certain kind of love and evolves into another that can't be, but it's a hard thing to rationalize, but it feels romantic, like that they were drawn together, even by her being like moved there. You know, it's like
and it's like, but also it's weird because the book is always rationalizing it as well.
Yep,
there are some dynamics that are like and yes, what a natural thing to do, but like everyone in this book knows this dynamic is weird.
Yep,
and everyone's constantly being like, what's going on with the kid and the priest?
Right. Well, why not, you know?
And even like Father Ralph de Brixart, I have to say it like that every time. For some reason, I can't ever say it normally. Even he's like, why do I feel this way about this child? Because there's even these bits where they go to school like in the city or whatever, Meggie and her older brother Stuart. Mm. And there's this really kind of a strange bit where he's like, he painted Meggie's room her favorite colors and got these beautiful like curtains. So every time she'd come to stay with him, she'd have the best things around her. And Stuart's room he left the same because Stuart was kind of an unavoidable thing.
Yep. But it's that he thinks she's special and he feels that way and he's acting on it. I feel like it's part of it is the action of someone actually doing, you know, doing romantic things like that. And as I use the word romantic, I'm like, ew, pinch. But
she's 9.
It is.
He's 30. She's 9.
Right. Yes. But it is romantic. Yeah. And also, when you think of his decision that he made, that was a safe outlet for him in some way, like a safe way to show love to a woman. Not to a woman, to a girl.
But to a female thing.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yes. To have a paternal sense of
because like, all these things he's never gonna have,
and especially if like that's why they give her all these awful brothers in this nightmarish existence, like because there's this one man who understands her and you know and is curious. Oh god, it all sounds so awful when you
when you're in the world of the book, you're like, oh, he's all she has. It's a very lonely book for women, this book,
right?
Because it's such a this is like Australia, the beginning of the 20th century, like you could, there's no harder life you can find.
Yeah.
Like, and all the men in the book sort of, and masculinity is really interesting in this book because like they all kind of rise to this challenge by becoming these weird independent things who only rely on each other, who disappear into the outback for days on their horses.
Yep.
None of her brothers ever marry.
Right.
They can form connections with women. It's just like them and the landscape. But yes. that relationship can't exist for Maggie because her family life is like, no, women stay indoors, men go outside.
Right. And it's, I feel like it was that heightened version, like for me, Are You There, God? Is Me, Margaret. Is
yes,
one of my
we're
favorites.
We're doing that soon.
Oh, you are? Okay. Yeah. But it was something I loved about that book too. When there's that element of like, I can't find out what I need to know and I don't think I can get what I want. And I feel like that's what this was. For, like, how could she understand anything about love, about men when they're all kind of the same and there's no one for her to bond with? And then to bond with someone who she can't be with, who also can't have that experience.
Ugh.
Like, it's just
so painful.
Devastating.
It is devastating, and it makes you believe in the sort of the drama and the romance.
Yeah, and the Romeo and Juliet of it, that they cannot, you know, that like what makes love true is when it doesn't work. Like, I know that's, I feel like that's
don't
the
tell
most,
me that.
I know. Yes. Well, like, look at her marriage, you know? Like,
oh, her marriage.
Like, I guess that's what I liked about it, because when you're a kid and you think, oh, I'm supposed to be excited about my wedding day, like, dream of that. And I was always, like, more prone to drama. Like, I would, when I was alone in my bedroom, be like, and you get out, like, fantasize about my divorce.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, so this was perfect feast for me of, like, see, there it is. Like, the marriage is, like, out of spite, out of, you know, settling. Like, it's just all kind of corrupt and doomed.
Yes. So while we're on the marriage, let's talk about the marriage.
I know.
I feel like we're so excited. We just keep raking past things. Right. But we'll come back to other
stuff.
Yeah,
no, we're, I feel like this is how it's going to be, because it's just, it is the zigzag of
this book. Mm-hmm. It just takes you places. So Maggie, Ralph, okay, we should go back to Mary Carson, actually, because that's the only way we can lead into this.
Back to Bunny.
So she sort of notices that they have this connection because she is a spider. And she writes a will on the eve of like her 75th birthday or whatever. She's basically about to euthanize herself.
Right.
Which is crazy and a baller move in this case.
Yep.
She's like, I'm ready to die. Blah, dead. And she writes two wills, one of which she's filed with her lawyer, where it's like, oh, the Clearys inherit everything, I think. And Father Ralph gets nothing. The second she leaves with Ralph, and he's like, basically, you can only read this after I'm dead, and like, you have to decide whether you're going to show them this will or not, which is they leave everything to the Catholic Church under the stewardship of Father Ralph, only under the conditions that he is elevated very high in the church.
Yep.
And the Clearys get to live on the land, and they make a decent money. And it's this perfect thing of like, and Father Ralph says it himself, where he's like, if they were throwing the Clearys out, if she was throwing the Clearys out.
Oh, that evil genius. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If she was throwing them out into the street, it would be an easy decision. But because all he wants in life is to like elevate, is A, Maggie, and B, to like escalate through the Vatican Church for some reason. And and he has to make the decision, and he decides to turn in the second will and become the most powerful man in the Roman Catholic Church, save the priest.
And you know that that was an easy decision for him too. And that was like, that's her understanding of him. Like that at the end of the day, like there was no real decision. Like because of that aspect of the family. Like that's where it was like, she is a special kind of manipulative creature.
Oh,
like to understand that about the family.
It's such perfect, even as a novelist, it's perfect plotting though,
isn't
it?
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it's melodramatic, because doing anything with a will is melodramatic.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's the most high drama document there will ever be.
Mm-hmm.
But to have it so like, it's not like, oh, misery or joy. It's like, they're both horrible options. You
right.
Know?
Yep.
And she's for precluding him ever leaving the priesthood to be with Maggie.
Yeah.
Know?
And then like, and kind of, just to drive home that idea that every commitment you make in life eventually like kind of dries out and becomes obligation.
Oh.
But it's like in your blood. That's what I remember, like that breaking my heart, that like, oh, he, come on, just love her. Like you love Maggie. But like, no, he's like, it's a part of him. And that Mary knew that.
Yeah, Mary,
that it wasn't like when there was all the like the dreaminess of that commitment was all kind of gone.
Because at this point as well, she waits until Maggie's 18.
Yep.
Like she's literally
you got to give props. Like,
props to Mary Carson, Mary Bunny Carson,
and then the drama that she's not even going to live to see like how it plays out. Like that kind of faith in yourself, that kind of baller move confidence, you know.
Yeah, I'm just going to go to my death knowing I'm going to hell. Because she is a religious woman and she believes in hell and she knows she's going there.
Oh, yes.
She's like, this is
And I think she'll do well there. She's probably running it by now.
She's running hell, man. Yes. Her and Bunny McDougal are running hell. And then her and Ralph have like this kind of kiss on that night. And then the next day, Mary dies and Ralph disappears in the narrative to go and pursue the church. Maggie's
and what an association built by that, right? The link between like the kiss and the death and the will,
yes,
like, all of that together.
Kisses
those
make
are the
death.
Yes, like that's that plotting that like, oh my god, that man, like how could he not forever associate those two things?
It's just such good melodrama.
Yes.
I read somewhere that Germaine Greer called this the best bad book I've ever read, and it really is. Like it's high art but very bad.
Yes,
So Ralph goes away immediately, and then Maggie is just like, well, fuck this. What am I going to do? She kind of marries the first person she sets eyes on, really, who's this guy called Luke O'Neill.
Oh,
and he's the worst, and he seems quite handsome at the beginning, but they always do.
Oh, they do. That's their specialty.
Yeah, tell me about Luke O'Neill. Tell me about your reactions to him.
An honest look at what a lot of marriages are like. That's what I thought of. Like, I don't want to. How do I say this without? Well, you know, when you're a kid and you're out in the world and you see other people, you see families. And on the surface, it's like, oh, they live together. They're a family. They're great. Yeah. And it's like, they don't seem happy. So it was like, I feel like it was the first book I read that really like, and that was showcased.
Yeah.
The origin story, not being, well, we fell in love and we're still
so
in love.
True.
And now we have our family. It was like, man, this is how people, certain parents get to be that way.
Right.
You know?
So it's like, and what's interesting as well is because they're both young, beautiful people.
Right.
Who meet in quite a dashing way on they're both on horseback and it's very like, oh. Like.
Yeah, so that can never be. And I like that cynicism too, that like if people are so caught up, like if we're focused on their looks, then it's that, you know, then something's a little bit off inside the way that like, you know, the sex is not exactly wonderful, to say the least.
So they get married and it's this very like sad wedding, and she won't let Ralph know about it because she doesn't want him to conduct the wedding because she's mad at him for choosing Jesus over her, which is fair.
I mean, that jerk. Yeah.
They had this like sad wedding. Maggie has inherited like £2,000, which he basically takes from her, and he says, hey, we're going to leave everyone you know now and we're going to go to some random place. I can't even remember where they go, but I'm going to cut sugarcane for years. Fuck you twice.
Yep.
And then like put you in like to be a maid in this elderly coupled house and like make sure that you have the worst life ever. It's awful.
And that that's what she's drawn to. Because I feel like if you've decided that you love someone and that that's, you know, that's what's for you and you can't have it, of course you're going to be drawn to like someone absolutely horrible.
Horrible.
Because your brain has kind of decided, like, never mind your heart, but your brain is like, oh, like true love cannot be. So
let's punish myself forever.
Yes, yes. Let's prove it. She definitely wants to be right about that, you know?
Oh, wow.
I think on a
subconscious
level. I never
thought of it that way. That's very smart. You're very good.
I think about this crap a lot. I do.
Yes, she wants it. Yeah. Because then there's her parents. So her parents have an identical story where her mother fell in love with a politician who was already married, had a baby by him, and then was like kicked off of her rich family and then had to go marry Paddy Cleary, who's a lovely man.
Yep.
But was never quite, it was always like this very empty shell of a woman because she never got what she wanted. So
right.
Just picks at this lovely man for
years. And then she grows up with that idea that all relationships that are existing are because of some element of default. That everyone secretly loves someone else or secretly wanted someone else. And that in life, but you have to pair off. You have to be in the foxhole with someone. So I feel like she learned that lesson. Plus to meet him, you know, to have Ralph and not be with him. It's like, that's a storm. There was no possible way for her to overcome that.
And it's also like this character who's already, it's weird to have a heroine who is like beautiful and spunky, but is also totally resigned to the fact that life is hard and no one has a good time.
Yes, you're like, honey, you're pretty. Like, go out. Like,
go to Sydney.
Yeah, like it's not that hard, you know, for you, you know.
Come on, you're rich, you're pretty, but you just want to make life as hard
and
for you.
Isn't that part of what's so interesting about it? Because I feel like when they talk about the beauty, it's one of those things as a kid that like surprises me looking back that I was like, oh, I was so rooting for her and loved her because I thought, well, those girls at school would be like that. Wasn't necessarily rooting for them.
Yeah.
But in that fictional universe of like, oh, we all identify with a beautiful
princess. Beautiful girl with the Titian hair and beautiful. The gray eyes.
Yes, I'm like, what? Like,
we're being like, what is Titian? For so, so much of my young reading life is, what is this?
Right.
What is Titian? Oh, God. And okay, so then, God, we're just whizzing through like hundreds of pages of plot as we speak here. Then her, like, thank God, because her landlady at like her job as a maid in this house where Luke abandons her is like, she has a baby called Justine, which is the most Australian thing to call your baby.
Yes, it is.
Justine and Dave.
And who's also just kind of the worst. Like, that was something else I liked about it.
Yeah.
You know, like, that, oh, to make a woman and just have her be, like, another, not like Mary bad, but just like, ugh, bad. Like,
yeah,
just, from childhood on. Like, I like that kind of, like,
Justine's
that
just
hopelessness.
A shitty baby and Maggie doesn't like her.
You know, like, when someone has a good baby, like, you're allowed to say when someone has a baby, like, oh, like, oh, they're sleeping. Oh, you got a good one. Good. But when someone has a shit baby, like, it's that awkward silence of like, oh, good luck with that. And it's like, that's a shitty baby. And it's, yeah, it's part of the melodrama.
Do you know,
like,
her relationship with, Maggie's relationship with her two children, Justine and Dane, is, you know, that gift of Arrested Development of Lucille, which is like, I love all my children equally. Yes. I never did care for Job. It's like, I never did care for Justine.
Right. And it's another chicken or egg. Like, was that kid born unlovable because born out of, like, you know, an absence of love?
Yes.
Or did she become that way because she wasn't loved and she wasn't wanted? And
yeah. You know, I really feel bad for Justine, man.
I know. I do. But then when she becomes annoying in life, it's like, I mean,
she
in book life.
She does become hella annoying.
Yeah.
I think it's, so we go from, oh my God. So we haven't even gotten to the,
My head's exploding.
Let's park Justine for a minute.
Yes. Yes. All right. You sit over there. Like,
I mean, that's Justine's whole life. Am I right?
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes, you are.
I'm having a lot of fun.
Oh, me too. Yes. I feel like they're all sitting out there. Like, it's nice.
It is nice.
We're conjuring them.
Yeah. Her boss at her job is like, girl, like, you need to like wash that man right out of your hair. I am going to pay for you to go on holidays. I'm going to take your baby. You're going to Matlock Island, which is like a cozy little beach island, where she goes and just hangs out for a week and like. Or for a few weeks, I think.
It's just a place to be beautiful.
A place to be beautiful. Where she just wanders around naked and goes swimming every day in her little cottage. And it's so good. It's so interior is porn as well. And while she's there, she learns to be a person. She's like on her own terms for the first time ever. And she's just like, you know what? I'm real mad at that Father Ralph because he basically like manipulated me into loving him from the age of 9. And ruined my life. And fuck that guy. And on day 10, he shows up.
Yep. Isn't that because they know? Like, that's one of the best aspects of the book. I feel like men feel those things.
I feel like they do.
Mm-hmm.
That's true, though.
Yep.
Like, the minute you're over a dude and then just like, oh, there he is.
Yeah. When they talk about women intuition so much, I'm like, I think the difference is that we know that we have it and we're in touch with that. But with men, they don't necessarily overall aren't as aware of it, but they just act on it.
Yeah.
So they do have it, but let's not let them know. You know?
That's a real thing in this book of like, there's like lots of like women characters being like, ugh, men don't know what they want.
Right. And like, yet, well, they do. And they're getting it, you know. Yeah.
So Father Ralph shows up and it's so good.
Yes.
Because she's just like furious at him, but also loves him. And she's just like, do you want a tea? And that's my Australian accent. Miggy, do you want a tea? And she's like, boils the kettle. And then they're just like staring at each other. And then they just get off with each other. And then it's just a blur of sex. Of like,
is it?
Not very well written sex, I have to say. But like, you're waiting for it for so long that you're like, oh, I'll take anything.
You know? Oh, yes. It's like pizza. You know, it's there. It's late. It's cold. It's not the best. But like, you eat it all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they spend like 4 or 5 days just in this cottage, like banging and swimming.
Yes.
And we see almost none of it, you know? It's very like Wuthering Heights, you know, when we never really see Kathy and Heathcliff together. We just know they are together.
That's a good point. Yes.
So it's like we never get to
And after all of this explicit, you know, like detail and all these pages, it's an interesting choice.
It's an interesting choice to kind of, it's almost like she wants to give them their privacy.
Yes.
Or like she can't like imagine what two people do when they're in love with each other because Colleen McCullough, not a nice lady. I did some research.
To read about her, what an awful thing. Yeah.
But so she was a brain doctor.
Of course. Yes.
She was like a proper, like she had a really horrible upbringing, similar to Maggie's, quite neglectful parents in the outback. And then she went to Yale to be a brain doctor.
Right.
And then one of her colleagues got rich writing Love Story. And then she was like, oh, just write like a failed tragic love story, money. And then that happened. And then she was resentful of her success forever. And just, she was just a real bitch.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Makes it like Mary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
She really became Mary. And I think she hated the TV show.
Yep. I think that's why she was probably so good with Mary. Like, because that was in her. And maybe, okay, so yeah, that explains also why she can't write that part of the book that is like this ultimate consummate
passion. The bit you're waiting
for. Because to write that and have that be in vivid detail would be to believe in it. And it's like, ultimately, she doesn't really believe in it. Because we don't.
She doesn't.
Yeah. It's like, that feels like, it's like a plot point, not a, you know, it ain't James Joyce. You know, it's not that like swooning, like, oh my God. It's just like, yep.
I know.
They're getting what they want.
Yeah.
For all of that florid language, like all the drama and the buildup.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it makes sense that she writes the dark in more detail than the.
And it's such a fuck you to your audience. To sort of be like 350 pages of will they, won't they? And then they do. And it's kind of like two pages. Yes. And you're like, how dare you?
He's a mean lady.
He's a mean lady.
Trying to out Mary Mary.
Ugh. And then, like. Ralph has to go back to Rome, but she's already got his baby.
Yep.
Which is weird because there's this whole thing in this book with like women taking babies from men.
Yes.
And that's very much the language. It's kind of like the reverse. You know how like generally the language around women being like impregnated is like, oh, and he had her and he put his thing in her and the seed, how it grew.
Planted, yes. Yeah, she's planted. The field and now, yes.
But the language around pregnancy in this book is like, I snatched the seed and now it's mine.
Yes. And that's insight into her, like maybe the neurological part of her outlook on life that like that's what women do. They steal, you know, they kick them, get that baby.
Yeah, and like, and there's this point where her, Maggie and her mother are having this conversation about how they both like stole babies from the men they loved best. And it was like, haha, he wants to go off and love God, but I have his baby. So joke's on him.
Yes. And then the baby is such a token and such a game piece and a chess piece and all of that. And that's what I think that's the other layer of it that I love, that like the comfort she has with this, like the meaning of the baby and not the love of the baby or like the, it's not like, oh, he's in here. It's like, ha, it's that last act, like, finger snap.
Yeah. And there's lots of people being like, fuck you, God. Do you know what I mean? You think you can steal Ralph from me, but I've stolen a baby from him. It's like she's doing a pact with the fairy queen or something.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm.
Well, when you have a love triangle with God, like, that's the way it goes. You know? And then when you think, the God of it all. Like, well, if you believe in God and think that God has something to do with making the baby, then it's like, well, God blessed this baby or, like, allowed this baby. So what do you make of that?
And that's kind of the lingo around it because it's very much like Dane's the best baby there ever
was. Oh, I know. Yes. And that makes you feel bad for, you know, a little old in the corner, Justine. But at the same time, like, everyone born out of tragedy is, like, more special.
Yeah, I wish I was born out of tragedy.
I know, I wasn't either. But here we are.
Here we are.
We can dream. But yeah, my mother's father was a teacher. Yeah. And my grandmother was a student. And she was his second wife.
Hello.
Yes. It was a thing where like he had, not had her, you know, like she was a student in his class. And then sometime later.
Oh.
I know. Creepy. She was a second
wife.
I love it. Yes.
I would love to know why... I can never be fully disgusted by these stories. I'm just like, ooh.
I know, me neither. Because they're intriguing. It's like, also, I guess if someone had to work for something or sweat over it, it's like, it has a little more weight to it, you know?
Yeah.
As opposed to like a New York Times, look, they met, you know, when they were both overseas and he was available and she had just broken up and look at them now. Like,
Yeah.
Too easy.
Something about the ill-fated, like, what are we going to do?
Yes.
You know, what are we going to do about our love? It's addictive. I love it.
And and it gives the love that, like, that overblown sense of meaning.
Yeah.
The way all, there's something also eternally, like, youthful about it, of feeling like when you're in love and you've never experienced it before, and it does feel like, I'm the first person. Like, everyone, I'll tell you what love is. Like, to me, that's what the book was of, like, this announcement, like, her self-importance.
Yeah.
And that he kind of bestows on her by paying attention to her and loving her was an interesting lesson to learn from this book.
Oh.
That, like, through...
It's like terminal uniqueness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As we will learn about
that.
In therapy.
Terminal uniqueness, yes.
It's like, I'm so special. No one can love me except
that I'm going to end up on a beach naked being beautiful alone. Yes, because that's how special I am.
That's how special she is. And then the rest of her, like, basically they have this one weekend. And I think they have this other weekend later on as well, from what I recall.
Right. Yeah.
Where he periodically shows up in Drada for a bang.
Right.
And
which
then,
when you look back on, like, what? Like, was that really? I mean, I guess he's got all that money, but it does feel extreme. That's part of the drama of, like, how far away it is. Like, it doesn't, Like, yeah. Really?
Yeah. Like, these people don't see each other for like 20 years at a time.
And they don't have Facebook. And I guess I love that. I like that confirmation when he returns that, like, that emotional feeling, because it's the only way to know, okay, someone was really thinking about me and someone did miss me. And I feel like that's where we live in the worst time.
Yeah.
Because we don't get that. The drama of separation.
Of someone
distance.
Just arriving at the door after 20 years. Yes. Like, first, there's got to be like a Facebook messenger. Hey, are you right, the Caroline I went to school with?
Yeah.
I always liked you.
Yes.
No one.
I like that accent too.
That's my like.
Like, what was that?
That is the voice I give everyone on the internet who gets in touch with you after a long time.
I like that.
Hello.
Yeah. It's a monotone of it.
It's like Siri's reading it or something, yes, you know? Yes. How do you feel about the final third of this book, or not even third, like quarter, I'd say, of just when it's just the kids doing stuff?
Not as good. I feel like, you know what, but the older I get, the more I'm like, it's hard to end a book, and this is a really good example of it.
Yeah.
Like, because I understood like the need for that part, but it's the letdown. Like, the final third, it was just a letdown for me.
Yeah.
Because it's like, they're just not as interesting. And then, like, you know, it's just, there's a difference between dark that, like, you know, is going to lead to light, and, like, that final darkness. Like, okay, like, death and, you
Dane
know.
Dane just does.
Yeah, drowns. That I remember being like, all right, like, come on, can we get back to, like, the hope, like, the pain with the hope mixed in?
Yeah, and it's just very much like, oh, this woman has had everything taken from her.
Right, like, even down, yeah, like, it was, for me, it was enough with him, like, wanting to join the priesthood. Didn't need to kill him on top, like, that's overkill, which I, like, it's in keeping with the world of the book, but yeah, there's not, like, the beginning of it is what, like, what won me over, I guess, like, what was enchanting.
And I feel like most people's memories of the final bit of this book are like, oh, I don't know, and she goes to London,
right, yes, but yeah, because it's there as filler, and then, but then when the more you write, the more I'm like, okay, like, it's not easy when you get to that end. Like,
it's very true. Yes. Yeah.
And it's like that paradox where it's the hardest part. It's the part we're all the most critical of, because there's that emotion mixed in with, like, this world is ending, because that's what I remember, like, realizing this book is going to end. Like, no, I live in this world. Yeah. I live in this world. So you're already primed to be critical and devastated. And then what happens doesn't live up to your expectations. So it's the 1-2 punch.
Oh, and it's weird as well, because I think this happens with me with all of generational books, where how they generally tend to go, the sort of arc of a generational book is that it starts off and everyone's shit poor. Mm-hmm. And by the end, people are like pretty well off.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just like reading about like Justine flying to Athens, and I'm like, fuck you, Justine.
Yes.
Your mother had to shit outside when she was your age.
Yes.
Your mother had no one to describe what periods were because they were too busy.
Right. And I think it does circle back to that, like, when those babies are used as props and game pieces, it's hard to care about them as adult characters. Because everyone reads it as in it. We're in it for Meggie.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember, like, being thrown by, like, oh, we're supposed to treat Justine like she counts. Like, she doesn't count. Like, she was never supposed to grow up. Like, she's a prop baby. Like, you know, when they have, like, fake baby, it's like, we just needed her for...
And you can tell...
To have some good conversations.
And, and you can tell that McCullough is doing that as well, because she keeps throwing more attributes at Justine. She keeps giving her these exciting things. Like, she makes her a famous actress.
Yes.
She makes, like, this, like, famous guy in, like, the German government fall in love with her.
Yes.
It's very weird.
And you could make her do anything, and it would still be like, she's just Justine. She's just not Meggie. Like, it's just not...
We just don't care.
Uh-huh.
It's just Justine.
It's
in the name, man.
Yes. just Justine.
I was reading some like criticism of this book that I'm amazed it didn't occur to me when I was rereading it, which is that it is amazing that somebody wrote like a book that spans like 70 years or whatever, set in Australia in the 20th century, and to not mention the Aboriginal population at all. Like, it's like... White, like,
yes, mm-hmm.
It's mad that it never comes up, right?
Yeah, and in keeping with her, like, I feel like the more you read about her and her personality, you wonder if that was a little maybe intentional, or like just part of her, like, I don't know, controlling issues of like, I'll just pretend that part of this doesn't exist.
Yeah, like even Germaine Greer called it like literary genocide. I was like, well, she kind of has a point. And she was like, well, should this really be a modern classic when it's like completely ignores like the people who had to like die or be kicked off the land for Drogheda to even exist? This place, this geographical
like,
location.
Like, how about that tragedy?
We all love. Yeah. And it is amazing how even they spend like all these male characters spend so long in the bush, and they just come up across nature and nothing else.
That
you know?
Is true. Yes.
What do you think of those brothers? Because whenever they come up, I just skip.
Yeah, because they were another, like, game pieces. Like, again, like, that was part of what drew me in was her, you know, having these brothers and, like, being the only girl. It's, again, that special only girl in the world, you know.
And she is the only girl in the world.
Right, like, all the songs are written for that feeling of, like, oh, what if you were the only girl on an island of boys, but they're all your brothers. I feel like that was the beginning of, like, the tragedy of, like, oh, all these boys that are basically of no use to her and they're all kind of interchangeable. And, none of them are ever going to get married. Like, they're just kind of there. So it was also hard. Yeah, you want to skip those parts because they don't really land because they were – it's just Meggie. World,
right?
And I feel like it could be 200 pages shorter if there was more comfort with that and going to the narcissism of that, which would also make sense of the cultural exclusions. You know what I mean? Like if it was just more like, all right, screw everyone. It's just Meggie. Let's not pretend that anyone else is a full-blown character where we're going to get into part of their story, but just because it's a family saga, it is, but it isn't. It's not like a Michael Cunningham book where you're invested in every character over many years.
Yeah, because you're not. Them. You're invested like Meggie and maybe her mom and Ralph, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But even...
And Mary. Yeah.
The women. The women and the priest who can't have sex.
Yeah. That makes a good baby.
Makes a good baby. But even his things when he's alone, like whenever it's in Rome, with I'm just like skip.
Those bits. Yeah. Even just no.
Because it is a like nice page try, book, I guess. But you can skip lots of it.
Yes. Big reveal at the end. We don't know the whole book. Yes.
Yeah.
Because, like, it didn't – it's just there's no comparison. And it's almost like if she wrote that now, I feel like there would be that time apart where the editor would be like, you know, maybe some of this can go.
Yeah.
Because we'll lean into this, like –
it's amazing that this was, like, her second book only. That,
right.
Like, so – and her first book wasn't even very successful. Like, that her editors, like, were they just, like, not as, like – I care less back
you know,
then?
On some level, I'm like, think about all that paper, all that handwork. That is what fascinates me about, you know, older times that I'm like, I mean, I write on my phone a lot. Like,
where
you can delete and erase so easily. Can you imagine being that editor and getting this and then having to think about a conversation about it with all those pages and all of that mapping? So I understand where it would just be like, no, everyone can, they'll know to skip. Yeah.
People know, reward the reader.
It's intuitive.
It is. What's your relationship to the TV series?
I saw it and it was hurt my feelings a little bit because she's just so pretty. And, you know, you read a book like this
and
you cast yourself in it. Exactly. I mean, no one's ever told me we look like each other.
But in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Perfect. But without even knowing it. Oh, that's me.
Hi,
so
it was
like, Megan. Wait, they're doing this all wrong. Like, that's not her. But I mean, I liked it. And him, I mean, he was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's so like golden. And I feel like every time they shot him, he was just beautiful and bathed
very,
in the
golden
light.
Very like Brad Pitt in Legends of the Fall. Like birds come out every time he's on screen.
Yes.
If you were like redoing it today, do you think, first of all, two-prong question, do you think it would work? Because do you think people have enough understanding of like a priest's role in society?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think right now, just because of where we are right now with what, you know, with all of the, we're in the, like the darkest time with all of that to me, where it's all been exposed, like it's been exposed for so long, but I feel like we're like.
Scar tissue has not formed yet.
Yeah, no. And it's like, and it also would, I'm sure someone would feel like, oh, they're choosing to like romanticize a priest right now. And also because it's a heterosexual relationship and we think of them as molesting little boys.
And because they met when they were so young.
To me, there would be a stigma. It would be a whole thing. Like, I still think it's a beautiful
story. It would be like
story.
Think Piece Central.
It would be, oh my God, there would be think pieces. And then there, I hate it.
Oh, it would be, it would suck. But
it
even
really
so,
would.
Who would you cast?
Right, yes.
It would suck bad, but who would you cast?
Yes. Like, if we could get in the time machine, a young Jennifer Grey. Because that's kind of how I picture Dirty Dancing Jennifer Grey.
Beautiful.
Like before
Excellent
Nose Job. Had
choice.
That. She has that, like, I guess that's what I, like, had projected onto her of that, like, not, no matter how much there was about the beauty of feeling like it was more about her quirkiness.
Kind of a cultishness to
her. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's a good one.
And as long as, and a Dirty Dancing. I mean, Patrick Swayze had that. Because you would need someone who has that ethereal quality.
Yes.
And that, and God, that you would believe that they were going to the priesthood. And I feel like there are a lot of actors that I love, but. Chris Pratt ain't joining no priesthood. You know what I mean?
Like, you couldn't just throw in one of the Chris's, could you?
Right, yes.
You absolutely could not.
Like Ryan.
Chris Pine, perhaps.
I was going to say Chris
Pine.
Pine
is the most soulful of the Pine.
I would kind of believe that, yes. And, Ryan Gosling.
Oh, I could see him doing that, yes.
He has that self-sacrifice.
I bet they would age up Maggie so she was like 15 when they met.
Oh, of course. And then it would be different too because she would be too self-aware.
Yeah.
And that would be part of the problem. Like I just like that being born into something down to the, you know, the brothers, the isolation. It goes back to that, are you there, God? It's when you're full of these questions and you don't know anything. And like, and even though there's some, isn't there a part in there where they talk about the books in the house? Like there's no way for her to know anything about sex, about body parts because no one talks about it. It's like that when you're in this, like enmeshed in this mystery where you're completely uneducated. And, you know, it's the eyelash batting of it. All of this, which I feel like would play terribly in our world right now.
Oh, so badly. But I kind of love the garbage fire of it, though.
I know. When,
Oh, there's definitely going to be like a Greta Gerwig's Thornbirds.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I look forward to that.
And maybe she could be 12. Maybe that would be like a happy medium.
We're negotiating what's still a child, but not too perverted.
Right. Like, just get that first period. You know, in there.
What a weird place to end this
podcast. I know. As soon as that was out of my mouth,
I'm
like,
uh-oh. Let's not end it there. Instead, you're going to tell me about your incredible work, and you've got a new book out that's quite different to your previous stuff. You're kind of edging into the supernatural, which I'm very excited for.
Yeah,
you.
A little twist of it. It's one of those unrequited love stories. It was part of my, like, I wrote it when I was in my, to me, the craziest, mentally craziest year of my life, which was 38, 39, and hyper-analyzing everything. Whereas to me, turning 30 was like a lighthearted blast of like, where should I have the party? And turning 40, for whatever reason, and I'd had friends go through it who had told me, but it's kind of, you know, you're like, oh, I'll be different.
Yeah.
And it was this quiet internal, like, taking stock, retracing every step, like thinking about everything. I joined a gym. I became a gym person.
I have recently joined
a
gym.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I'm turning 30 this year.
Oh, so, yep, that's how it works.
That's how it works. You turn a whole age and then
31.
You join a gym.
Oh, I haven't been there in 10 months. Yes. And so, yeah, it's a love story about kids that get separated and they're kind of in their identity. The best part of themselves they can only reach through being together, but then they have to, like, figure out how to be good on their own and they're not so good at it.
Oh.
Yes. So it's, it's not un-Thornbirdsy. And then my first two books are You and Hidden Bodies and You is the Netflix series. And I just finished writing a third Joe book.
Oh, wow. Yes.
And he's another one who never quite gets what he wants. I mean.
Love it. Yes. Loving your work. And loving meeting you today.
You too. This has been so long in the making. I'm so happy.
Right? This is like the most fun I've ever had with a total stranger.
Yeah.
Without paying them. This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast, thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.